This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, John le Carré, hasn't stopped writing novels since he hit it big in 1963 with The Spy Who Came in from the Cold. Even though the Cold War, which he detailed so well in such books as Smiley's People, came to an end more than 15 years ago. He's found other complex, challenging, and controversial topics about which to write, as in his novel The Constant Gardener, published in 2001. It's about a British diplomat living in Kenya who ends up investigating a possible conspiracy between high-level African and Western officials to encourage illegal drug experimentation on poor, suffering Africans. The Constant Gardener has been made into a movie opening next week. It stars Ralph Fiennes as the diplomat and Rachel Weisz as the woman who opens his eyes to the pharmaceutical conspiracy. Le Carré is more informed than most about the secretive ways of high-level governments and organizations. Before becoming an author, he worked for 5 years at the British Foreign Service under his real name, David Cornwell. His boss told him he needed to adopt a pen name if he intended to write books, and he settled on John le Carré. Terry spoke with John le Carré in 1989, shortly after the fall of the Soviet Union.
You started writing books and, well, publishing, getting your books published in the early 1960s, and that coincided with the time of the popularity of Ian Fleming's James Bond books. And I was wondering if you'd read those books and if they helped you decide what you did or didn't want to do in your own fiction.
Yes, I owe a great deal to Fleming for one reason only, that Fleming produced, by writing that type of romanticized, heroic, amoral novel, he produced what you might call a counter-market, which I was able to satisfy. Literature had gone so far away from the perceived reality of the espionage business that that people were crying out to have their perceptions of the reality reflected in a new kind of book. And I would not for a minute pretend that I saw that as an opportunity. I'm not so strategic or tactical as that, but I had the luck to pick up what you might call the slack that was left behind by Fleming.
And you wanted to depict the spy more as a working man, in a way.
Yeah, I knew that world, and I knew the way it had worked, and I knew that what I had seen was ordinary men and women locked in an impossible conflict. They were like flies in aspic.
How were they like flies in aspic?
Well, because we were given these postures, these ideological postures that were irreconcilable, and we worked within them, and we tried to tease the other side. I mean, in the high day of the Cold War, we were into things like trying to screw up youth conferences in Bucharest by putting itching powder on the lavatory seats and things of that sort. I mean, we forget what insanities were performed in the name of ideological purpose.
You use the word we, and I know you worked as a spy for a while. Was this one of your missions, having to put the itching powder on the...
Well, I was an intelligence officer.
Oh, okay.
this was not one of my missions. It's an enchanting notion that it would have been, but I'm afraid not. No, I'm speaking metaphorically. I don't know whether we did that exactly, but that type of thing was constantly on the drawing board or being put into effect.
Were you recruited to work as a spy?
Well, you can't do it independently.
Well, I never know whether you can kind of volunteer and then they check you out, or whether they seek you out.
Well, I think there are dozens of ways in which organizations do it. They have networks of talent spotters through the universities and the professional organizations. I think most recruiting organizations are very leery of people who come to them because they immediately suspect their motives. So they like to make their own selections in the first place.
Mm-hmm. So you were sought out?
That's not what I said.
Okay.
No, I don't want to answer that question.
Okay. Did your feelings for the job change as the Cold War progressed?
Yes, a kind of, as the French say, a cafard set in, a weariness of the spirit, which I tried to reflect in such characters as George Smiley. I also began to think it was damn silly that we were coming the victims of our own rhetoric, and that a situation could occur where we could make genuine advances and we would be so stuck in our own in our own rhetoric that we would never be able to get out of it. I sometimes worry that that's happening now.
Did you ever have an assignment that you didn't want to take on because you thought that, because you opposed its means?
Well, if I did, I certainly didn't speak up. I mean, you either accept the package or you don't. You can't pick on this one and say, I won't do it.
What kind of position did you hold in intelligence at the time you started writing fiction?
I'm really not going to talk about
that. Oh, fine, okay. I never really know where one draws the line on
these
things.
That's okay,
so
it's fine. It's only I'll
let you draw it.
Dangerous.
Excuse me?
It's only the answers that are dangerous.
when you started writing fiction, whose clearance or permission did you have to get, especially since it was spy fiction?
Well, if I had been even an orthodox foreign servant, I would have had to obtain clearance from my employing department, even if I'd written a book on Lepidoptera. As it was, I submitted my novels and they never met with any objection. And I think that professional spies, professional intelligence officers reading that material would know, in fact, that these were abstractions from the reality, just as any novel is an abstraction from reality. And they were not disturbed that I had portrayed the authentic world. They became disturbed when they realized that what I had portrayed was much more than authentic, namely, it was credible.
Were they afraid that the kinds of ambiguities that you were raising would be dispiriting to your readers?
Yes, I think so. I think that came back to me at least from one or two espiocrats in the American...
Oh, I like that word.
I do too, thank you. It's entered my new book. In the American structure, that I was undermining the very spirit which should fire young recruits to the agency or to the intelligence community. I was very entertained by that.
You were entertained by that?
Yes, because I think that in fact what I did was discuss quite often, rather unmercifully, the impossible gap between the dream and the reality. I said that these were not supermen and superwomen. They were people of ordinary quality, some good, some indifferent, and some lousy, just like in any outfit, who were trying to do an impossible job. I also raised the rather nasty moral question of how much you can do in defense of a society and make sure that its society is still worth defending.
Was it obligatory for you to get a pen name?
Yes, it was. It was. They said, choose another name, and I went to Victor Galanx, who was my publisher in London, and said, I've got to choose a pseudonym. And he said, well, my boy, I give you some good advice. Choose two Anglo-Saxon monosyllables, like Chunk Smith. And I was sufficiently perverse to choose three names, all of them a confusion, but two of them French.
Why a French name? I can't really figure that out.
I can't figure it out either. I have, in the past, when I was less secure, invented a number of fictions to explain why I did it, which seemed to satisfy journalists at the time. But now I have to admit I really don't know where the name came from.
Can I suggest a reason, though? This probably isn't
Please
it at
do.
All. But if you were a Frenchman, then the English readers would say, well, this is an outsider anyways. How intimately could he really know our system? Maybe it's better and things are more black and white than he's making it seem.
Ah, oh, there's wily French.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, it's quite, yes, it's the thought. It means a lot of things, I believe. It means square. A bal carré is a dance where people wear masks, I think, and change partners. Then in roulette, a number, if you make it carré, you've got a token on each corner of it. So it has a lot of applications, but I really don't know which one I fell for, whether I fell for any of them.
Were your publishers good at protecting your identity?
Well, in the beginning, for my first two little books, I hardly had an identity to protect. Then with The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, the English Sunday Times correspondent in Bonn rumbled me and blew my cover in the Sunday Times, and after that it was open season.
And that's about the time you retired from intelligence work anyway.
That's right, 1963. I left the Foreign Service.
Because you had enough money to from the income of the book?
I had enough to get going. I had told my accountant that if ever I was worth £20,000 or $30,000, that would be enough. I had three kids. And, of course, it's a derisory sum now with which to set out into the blue as a professional writer. But at the time, it seemed a fortune. He sent me a telegram saying I had that money. And so I handed in my resignation and set off with my kids and my wife at that time to the island of Crete in the Aegean. And I spent 18 months there trying to work out who I was and writing another book.
John Le Carré speaking with Terry Gross in 1989. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1989 interview with John Le Carré. His 2001 novel, The Constant Gardener, has been made into a movie that will be released next week, starring Ralph Fiennes.
Mole is a word that you're credited with having brought into the English vocabulary. I think you borrowed it from the Soviets, really. What was the origin of that?
Well, I thought I borrowed it from the Soviets, but the editors of the Oxford English Dictionary can't find any Soviet reference to mole.
Oh.
The origin was in the notion of a mole, somebody who burrows deep into the fabric of our society, is a little observed, little noticed thing, creature, and then from inside causes its downfall. And it's certainly now become a notion. I think they used to be called sleepers in the CIA, agents you put in place and you don't invite them to do anything risky, anything that could compromise them for years and years and years while they work their way into a position of power. And Philby was one such example, of course, but Philby, on the other hand, did have a reporting responsibility to his Soviet masters from very early on and fulfilled it from very early on and got away with it.
Coming in from the cold is another expression that you coined.
Well, yes, I suppose so, or at least I applied it to espionage. I suppose I was the first person to do that.
And what was behind that?
Well, behind it was the character of Alec Lemus in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, who was an old professional agent, an aging professional agent, who was suffering from what you might call a kind of spiritual metal fatigue. And he was offered one last mission, and he was told that when he had completed it, he could come in from the cold.
But, I mean, how did you come up with the expression?
Well, it's a meteorological perception. It's cold out there and it's warmer indoors, and the chill comes from a lack of human contact or a lack of human affection, of having to keep what Graham Greene called the chip of ice in your heart all the time, which is also a writer's condition to a point. I guess that even then I was aware of a comparability between the position of a writer in his environment and that of a spy, that both, in a sense, trade off the people around them. They note things and they report them. Both are dependent upon the people they deceive, and both, in a sense, have to be entertainers to be accepted.
Well, how does a writer have to deceive?
Well, I think that chip of ice to which Graham Greene refers is really some kind of recording instrument. L.P. Hartley said, "Don't leave me in your drawing room. I'm sure to read your letters." I don't read people's letters, but there is a part of me, as there is of most artists, that stands back from most experience. I never know whether that is what the French call a professional deformation, which comes from practicing the craft, or whether people of that disposition are drawn to the craft in the first place.
And how does a spy have to be an entertainer?
Most of them have to have entertainment value, particularly if they are going to recruit people. Alas, we've never met, but I'm sure you're beautiful and young and elegant, and if I were determined to obtain your services and turn you around and get you to report upon your organization, you'd be unlikely to come and have lunch with me if I wasn't a person of some charm and entertainment value.
And knowing how to flatter people.
And knowing how to flatter people, and more particularly knowing how to make people dependent on you, because once I had obtained you, you would then have to continue working for me. And you would have to have a reason, and if it wasn't love, it would have to be ideology, or if it wasn't either of those things, it would have to be money.
Now, you had talked about how there are similarities between writing and spying, and you've mentioned another similarity in your life to spying, and that is that when you were growing up, you felt like something of a spy in the world of the educated middle class because your father was something of a con man and was convicted of embezzling.
Yeah, the class is the thing. We were, my brother and I think, were elected by my father to make that leap from blue collar to white collar. In England, from lower class to middle class, from state education to private education. In England also, people are determined to a great extent, are categorized by the way they speak. If they speak like gentlemen, they're liable to be taken as gentlemen. And so your speech is like what you wear. And so we were dressed and groomed and launched upon the target institution, that is middle class society, very much as little agents, perhaps. And we alone knew what kind of chaos we came from and what kind of chaos we were going to return to.
What kind of chaos did you come from?
Well, from a totally unorganized and unprincipled background, mainly in, I think, in my brother's and my early life, very erratic from holiday to holiday, not knowing where we would be or who would be looking after us, whether my father would be there or whether it would be one of his ladies who was looking after us. And or we would go to my grandparents and we would be good Christians while we were there. And sometimes we had a ball. We went to St. Moritz, or we went and went to the races and watched one of my father's horses running. And then luck would turn, and we'd be farmed out to somebody who hadn't got very much money and lived in very simple circumstances. So life was about the possibilities of experience, and of course novels are about that too.
Were you supposed to not tell your father's real life to your teachers or friends?
We never received that instruction, but we always somehow knew that that went with the territory. Certainly we knew that we should never tell my grandparents about the way my father lived. We never, for example, mentioned the racehorses or the ladies or the Bentley cars or all that stuff. But I think my grandparents knew very well.
Well, you once said that you think your father used you as his cover.
I don't think so. I think it was much more that if the nature of hypocrisy is that it is the tribute that vice pays to virtue, we were to be the virtuous objects of his vice. It was his wish that we should in some way be perfect, and that would justify his existence.
Did you know when you were young that your father was a fraud in a way?
Sure, sure. I just assumed everybody was.
That everybody was a fraud?
Yeah, I thought that's what grown-ups were.
He, I think, had a lot of creditors during a good deal of his life.
Yes.
Was it ever useful for you to have a pen name instead of your birth name of David Cornwell, so that people after the Cornwell family, who were owed money, wouldn't be coming after you? Knowing that John le Carré had all these bestsellers.
Well, I'm afraid that the links were very quickly made, and even after my father's death, I continued to receive letters from outraged Austrian countesses who had lent him their masterpieces to have them restored free at Sotheby's and were still waiting to have them back. And my father also presented himself to a Berlin film studio and said that he was acting for me and was considering renting the studio to make The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, a thing which puzzled Paramount considerably because they knew nothing of this. But on the strength of this, they paid a lot of his hotel bills and provided him with a car for a couple of weeks in Berlin, that kind of thing.
So what did you tell them?
I told them they had made a mistake. Many of us had done it, and most of us had paid for it.
And were you liable in any way?
No, not really. In the more human cases, I tried to pay off at least some of the debts, but It was a very big bill. And in many other cases, I thought, well, hard luck, you got what you deserved. You knew it wasn't quite straight and you went for it. You were greedy. You got your fingers burnt.
Did you and your father ever reconcile?
No, it was not really possible. I mean, I offered to maintain him, I remember, on the condition that he didn't work. Because it was too expensive. But but that enraged him. And he was what he was. You can't come to terms with a phenomenon like that. It goes on living in you forever, really.
John le Carré speaking with Terry Gross in 1989. The Constant Gardener, a new movie based on le Carré's 2001 novel, opens next week, starring Ralph Fiennes. Le Carré's first literary success, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, is about to be reissued. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.